We are joined by Shireen. She's a clinical psychologist, executive director at UniHealth, and she's also the president of Psychology Association of Namibia.
Thank you for having me.
My first question is, how would you define mental health?
So actually, mental health is actually a lot broader than people think. It includes our emotional, psychological, and social well-being. And it's basically how we think, what we feel, and then the way we act. And it helps us determine how we handle stress, you know, how we relate to others, and how we make healthy choices. So mental health isn't just, you know, when you see someone with a mental health disorder, when there's a problem. Mental health actually encompasses everything that makes us think, feel, and act and behave in a certain way in our community and in society.
Shireen, what is the difference between a psychological counselor, clinical psychologist, social worker, and a psychiatrist?
So, Angie, this is a really good question because I think a lot of people get confused in terms of what kind of assistance they do require. And it's important for people to understand the differences between mental health care service providers in order for them to make a good choice or decision in terms of who to go and see and where to actually access the help. So I'm going to start with psychiatrists because the psychiatrists are actually medical doctors and they are qualified to also prescribe medication. So when a client is quite depressed or anxious or overwhelmed or has sleeping problems, they would go and see a psychiatrist who will then be able to prescribe medication. So it's a very physical participation from the psychiatrist side in terms of the medical knowledge. And the psychiatrist will also, of course, then do a little bit of therapy with them if the psychiatrist is one of them who prefers to do some therapy, or alternatively, the psychiatrist might then refer to a psychologist. Psychologists, we also have quite a number of different ones. In Namibia at the moment, the only registrable categories are educational psychologists and clinical psychologists, but you also in other countries find that psychologists kind of specialize. So you might find counseling psychologists, neuropsychologists, forensic psychologists. But in our country, we have educational psychologists who focus more on learning and helping individuals with struggling with learning disabilities, learning disorders, difficulties in school, family problems, more of a functional role that they play, also a lot of psychometric assessment, so the tests that they do. And then you have the clinical psychologists who are more focused on helping with disorders, so people with depression, anxiety, any other clinical problems that they might have, suicidality, you know, substance abuse. Clinical psychologists are then the one overseeing the therapeutic process with these clients. And then the clinical psychologists are also involved in neurotesting as well as forensic work. What we do also have in Namibia is if people have specialized, so if they have a doctorate, they can also then work within another category as per their specification. So the psychiatrist will refer to the psychologist, making sure that they do the therapy that is part of the person's treatment plan. If the psychiatrist and the psychologist are not needed, we then also have the psychological counselors. So psychological counselors are basically our first line, I want to say like the first defense we have, you know, in the mental health scenario. So when somebody, for example, has family problems at home, a child is struggling, there's difficulty and they need support in terms of counseling, whether it is, you know, maybe for a crisis they went through, maybe there is a problem with, you know, in the community with HIV, our psychological counselors are our first line. So they will be the ones taking the responsibility to do the basic screening, making sure that if this person does, however, exhibit something that is more clinical or more problematic, that they then refer up to a psychologist or a psychiatrist. And then, of course, we have social workers who plays a very important role in terms of being the glue between all these different parties, but also between the family and the economy. Well, I'm saying economy because they are the ones who are actually driving the community work, and they are the ones also who will be working from a legal perspective. So your social workers, if there, for example, is GBV, then the social workers will be the ones responsible for making sure that all the legislative processes are in place. So whether that is going to the police station, doing the correct way of reporting the incidents, etc., even going to court when it comes to family and custody, the social workers play that role. And what's really important for people to understand is that when you look at mental health and the different roles each of these disciplines play, then they work together. So you might find that a psychologist is doing some of the therapy for the child, and the social worker is working with the parents in terms of a parenting plan and going to the court, etc., etc. And then the psychiatrist might actually also be prescribing some medication, you know, to either the adult or to the child, you know, if there's a learning difficulty, etc., etc. So it's always a little bit of a multidisciplinary approach when you look at mental health.
Then a very important question, what are the implications of stigmatization of mental health in Namibia?
When we stigmatize, we are telling people that what they're feeling and thinking is not normal. So we're making them feel isolated, we're making them feel like they are different. And what happens is that people start behaving like that. You know, people think that there's something wrong with them. Because if we look at something like depression, for example, or suicidality, or even GBV, and we're saying to people, yeah, it's not normal to feel depressed. It's not normal, you know, that your husband beats you. Then people don't want to speak about it because they actually feel that there's something wrong with them. So when we stigmatize mental health, you know, when we stigmatize how people feel, we're actually taking away the opportunity from them to be able to access help and services because they feel ashamed, they feel shy, they feel guilty. And that's what stigmatization does to our community. So people don't speak out and they don't look for healthy coping mechanisms. They fall back onto unhealthy coping mechanisms such as substance abuse. We know Namibia is in the African region fifth at this point in time in terms of substance abuse. Specifically alcohol, and then you know in the African region we are fourth in terms of suicides, and this is a sign that we are not coping as a nation. And the reason we're not coping as a nation is because we stigmatize being able to speak up about our mental health.
Shireen, how can family and community help?
Angie, I think the first thing is to be more accommodating and accepting and to educate ourselves. You know, we need to have a better understanding of what mental health really is and the impact of mental health on our communities and on our family members. So as family members, as community members, we need to start, like I say, you know, understanding, reading up, educating, and then also from a mental health care professional side, we need to start advocating in terms of why it is important to be able to express ourselves, why it's important to be able to look after our mental health, you know. And I think the one good thing that came from COVID is that a lot of people who would have never really had any exposure to mental health or any situation adverse enough to challenge their own mental health were actually challenged and exposed during COVID. And what happened is that these people, and most of us, you know, actually realize that it's not just talking about it. It actually can affect anyone at any point in time. And that creates a bit of a universality. So you can kind of identify with people going through depression. You can identify with people going through isolation and trauma and loss and grief. And I think COVID sort of highlighted that for the communities and for the countries. And that was one of the only things that I really think was important because it made mental health more inclusive. And as family members and community members, we need to understand that mental health is as a crucial part of our lives, an important part of our lives as our physical health.
What is the implication of stigmatizing men's emotional needs, the men don't cry dilemma?
I think, again, it faces back, Angie, to the problem that because it's not a healthy coping skill to avoid things, you know, the moment we start avoiding, and that is what we do when we deny our own emotions and deny emotions of others, then we're trying to find ways of coping that's not healthy. And again, this is why in our country we see escalation in GBV, because when I'm angry, I don't know what to do with my emotions because I'm not allowed to express them in a healthy way, or I've never learned how to express them in a healthy way. And then I turn over into trying to resolve it in a way that I know or seen or have learned. And then, for example, you find there's GBV, you know, somebody lashes out and beats someone else. You find that there is substance abuse, all these kind of negative coping mechanisms that are not healthy for you. So the fact that we don't speak out, the fact that men don't have the opportunity to voice their emotions or to seek help is actually to the detriment not only of the men themselves, but also to their families and their communities.
What is your opinion if poorer communities are provided with these services? How can we accommodate these communities?
I think it's very important that we start on the basic levels, and I think, because there's a lack of resources in terms of being able to provide every person with a counselor, we need to find alternative ways to service these communities. One of the ways is definitely through technology, but it's also difficult because you need to understand to what extent they have access to this technology. But apart from that, there's also psychoeducation. So one of the first and basic principles of trying to challenge and change something is educating people. And we need to make sure that there is an educational flow into our schools, into our churches about mental health, about the stigma around it, about the fact that there's help available. Because at the end of the day, once people are educated, the communities can also start supporting each other. If we understand mental health better, if we understand the importance of being able to express ourselves, and we start bringing this into our cultures, then those will be the first step to aid communities who can most definitely, in most of the cases, not really afford, to be able to see someone on an individual basis. What we can also do, Angie, is we can support, initiatives that are driven by NGOs, donor funders, etc., looking after the mental health of the community. So, support Lifeline, for example, they do a beautiful job when it comes to looking after people's mental health disorders. We are actually at the moment also going to be running a whole campaign with Roundtable in Namibia or in Windhoek, the Valvicha 213 Roundtable group. It's coming up with a nice mental health awareness project on the 15th of October at Marua Mall, and Virgin Active is also going to be involved, where different companies will be having a challenge in terms of, a walking challenge, but it will be in the mall, and we're hoping to raise some awareness through these kind of opportunities. And then that money, at the end of the day, will be used, all the funds raised will be used to teach teachers basic counseling skills, because as I said, when we start at the schools on an educational level, we can start with the kids on a very, very basic building block of understanding their own mental health and wellness. And then, of course, we want to make sure that if there are kids in these schools, that they then also have access to services.
Our country is very traditionalist, and culturally, mental health concerns are seen as taboo. How do we change this perspective?
Information needs to flow from the top down, and we know that people also in Namibia follow their leaders. So when we look at mental health, it's no different. The way that our community leaders treat each other, treat their wives, their children, their friends, their fellow community members, will be the way that our children will also inevitably be treating one another. So we need to start drawing in from a high level community members that are representative of certain populations. So whether it is our pastors in our churches, whether it is our traditional leaders up in the north, our ministry, our schools with our teachers. Once our leaders and the people who are basically in charge of our country start looking after their mental health and advocating for mental health, then it's the only opportunity for us to try and break the stigma that has been there in terms of culture and the way that we've been raised to think about it. So we need to start challenging it. And the only way we can challenge that is by our leaders taking our hands and saying, let's, look at mental health in a different way and support people and, those who want to speak up about it as far as possible.
Shireen, what is the importance of psychometric testing for children and adults?
So psychometric testing is quite broad. But I think, just to maybe put it in perspective, psychometric testing helps, healthcare professionals to come up, for example, with treatment plans, to come up with diagnoses. So we utilize psychometric testing in order for us to draw up a treatment plan for a person, whether it's a child or an adult, to aid and help and assist them in order to fulfill whatever the basic living skills is that they require, whether that is being able to go to school with certain help, whether it's being able to manage a psychological condition better. The role of psychometric testing is to help us to clarify what we are working with and then to kind of build and guide on where we will go with our either therapeutic process or clinical process or educational process that we need to follow.
Why is it important to have a work-life balance?
Angie, yes, I think that is one of the things people really do struggle with, you know, being a parent, being a mother, father, and having a household, I mean, trying to balance that with obviously being a manager or just a colleague or a, you know, employee, and this is on all levels, you know, and then being a friend, being a daughter, a son, so many different roles that people have to play. And you know, with all the pressure that people are experiencing, especially after COVID and the recession and people getting back into work and the changes they're facing there, all the trauma people face, it's very important that we don't forget to try and keep a balance between our lives and our work, you know. And work is obviously also a part of our lives, but what we tend to do is we tend to neglect one part and it costs the other part, because we don't make enough time for ourselves, for our children, for our family, for our friends, you know. Life is about, I almost want to look at it as a pie chart. And when we look at it as a pie chart, it's like, you know, we need to have a space for all the areas of our lives. You know, so we need to make time to be a parent. We need to make time to be with our friends and be social. We need to make time to actively exercise and look after our bodies from a health perspective. We need to make time with our partners. And then obviously we need to make time to have some spiritual engagements. And then we also need to make time to look after our mental health, you know, to maybe read a book or paint or, you know, have some sort of hobby or free time. And then apart from that, we need to also have our work and make sure that we fit in what we need to in terms of being able to do our work. So managing and balancing that can become really, really tricky, especially if we are in a corporate situation where there's a lot of pressure on us, or if people are working very long hours and shifts, like nurses, police workers, you know, it becomes very difficult to get that balance. And it's important for us to look into ourselves, to maybe go up and draw that sort of pie chart, and then ask ourselves, you know, are we, does it look balanced? Or is it, you know, that you're coloring in one specific area, whether that is work or whether that's something else, and we are actually neglecting the rest of that little pie chart. So yeah, work-life balance is extremely important. I think often we don't realize just how out of balance we are because we are juggling all these different roles and balls. But I would really advise people to go and sit down and reflect and think about, you know, what does your pie chart look like? And if it's not really nicely balanced, what are you going to do to try and rearrange the balance within your life?
Shireen, just the last question. Why is it important for companies to have corporate wellness implemented?
When it comes from the top, it becomes part of a company culture. So when the company shows that they care about people's mental health, they care about their psychological well-being and welfare, it tells people the company cares about them, and it actually provides a safe space for people to be able to look after their mental health and wellness without feeling that they will be judged, you know, or that there will be stigma around that. So companies, actually, when they have a good wellness system, they create a good culture for people, and people want to work in a company that looks after them. The latest studies done by WHO actually show that 80% of people were willing to leave a company because they are not feeling supported in terms of their wellness at that organization, which shows you that we often underestimate the impact that, you know, being understood, being looked after from a mental health perspective, you know, has on a person's well-being and on their happiness at the organization where they are working. So yes, if companies have a good wellness program, if they look after the employees, we know that there is less absenteeism, we know that there is presenteeism, and we know that the productivity of the individuals go up because, you know, it's almost like having a child. When your child feels looked after and taken care of and not being bullied in a way, because I think that's another horrible company culture we have out there where people feel that they're being bullied. So if we don't tolerate these things and we look after them, then that child will flourish, you know, in their home environment. This is the same at the office. They will flourish in their office environment if they have the opportunity to express themselves and they are being supported by the organization.
Shireen, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you, Angie. It was a big pleasure.